Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountainside. After he had sat down, his disciples gathered around him, and he began to teach them. How blessed are the poor in spirit. The reign of God is theirs. Blessed too are the sorrowing. They shall be consoled. Blessed are the lowly. They shall inherit the land. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for holiness. They shall have their fill. Blessed are they who show mercy. Mercy shall be theirs. Blessed are the single-hearted, for they shall see God. Blessed too the peacemakers, they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those persecuted for holiness' sake, the reign of God is theirs. Blessed are you when they insult you and persecute you, and utter every kind of slander against you because of me. Be glad and rejoice, for your reward in heaven is great.
If there is any passage of the New Testament which could be called Christ's manifesto, it's surely the one we've just heard. It's so familiar to us that revolutionary seems an exaggerated description. And yet this program for a new way of living was more subversive than anything Marx could have dreamed of. Nor did Jesus sit quietly writing down his ideas in the seclusion of the reading room of a great library. On the contrary, he proclaimed them from a hilltop. Or so Matthew writes. Luke suggests that he had come down onto the plain. But let's go back a bit in time, to the previous night.
Now it was about this time that he went out into the hills to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. When day came, he summoned his disciples and picked out 12 of them. He called them apostles. He then came down with them and stopped at a piece of level ground, where there was a large gathering of his disciples with a great crowd of people from all parts of Judea and from Jerusalem and from the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon.
As usual then, with the evangelists, we have an event recounted as happening in two different places, up on a hill, down on the plain. Perhaps if our Lord had been a Greek and lived in ancient times, he would have stood in the theatre at Epidaurus, where you can be heard by the whole audience, even those sitting right at the top, what we'd call the gallery, and he wouldn't have needed to raise his voice. But not only do Luke and Matthew set the scene differently, they also precede what we know as the Sermon on the Mount with different events. While Luke recounts the choosing of the 12 as taking place immediately before, Matthew only has Peter, Andrew, James and John called from their fishing. Finally, the Beatitudes themselves are presented differently by the two writers. But neither the place nor the order of events matters to our evangelists. Only what Jesus said or did. And as for the order in which he said things, this too is irrelevant. St. Augustine puts it best.
Anyone can see there's no point in asking in what order our Lord uttered these words, for we cannot fail to discover, on the most excellent authority, that of the evangelists themselves, that there is no failure of truth in giving a sermon in an order different from that in which it was first uttered. Whether the order was thus or thus makes no difference to the substance of what was said.
In the year 1187 AD, the Second Crusade, preached by St. Bernard, ended in failure when the Muslim Saladin captured Jerusalem, defeating the Crusaders on the mountain known as the Horns of Hattin. Situated to the west of the Sea of Galilee, or Lake of Tiberias, and rising to about 1,000 feet, it was, the Crusaders believed, where Jesus had preached the Beatitudes. But the shrine which stands on the Mount of the Beatitudes is not there, but further north. And as we read in the guidebook,
from it one can enjoy on the Lake of Tiberias one of the most wonderful views in Galilee. On the right it dominates the town of Tiberias, and below, at the foot of the shrine, there is Tabgha, with the shrine of the multiplication of loaves, and the shrine which commemorates the conferring of the primacy of Peter after the resurrection.
In 1964, Pope Paul VI came to the chapel at Tabgha, built over the rock where the first pope received the keys of the kingdom. Where the Sermon on the Mount was given, we have seen, is unimportant, but Jesuit Father Peter Rieger notes,
the mountain is mentioned since it's a parallel to the original mountain of Mount Sinai, where the first law was given to the chosen people. Christ is here represented as the new Moses, who gives the perfect law of the gospel. The crowds are not only Jews, but also people from Syria and the surrounding regions, which presumably includes pagans. Thus, the future universal nature of the missionary vocation of the disciples to all peoples is here implied. Through the disciples, Christ addresses himself to the whole world.
And now, before we leave the image of hill or mount to consider the Beatitudes themselves, let's listen to these lines by the Dutch artist Jan de Foe, based on an ancient poem known as the Song of Amergin. The theme is contemporary, that everyone should pay respect to and take responsibility for the environment they inhabit. The manuscript of the original poem, said to date back to 1268 BC, is in the library of the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin.
I am a hill where poets walk, mountain surrounded by dancing signs, words, lines of dreams, unspoken in daily happening, past and future intertwined, wild ranks of ever-growing green, reaching outward, down and upward, seeking the sounds of birds singing in the cold of winter's night.
Many interpretations have been given to the Beatitudes, many the explanations of their meaning and message. None can be definitive. So I've made an arbitrary choice of the thoughts of a few people on some of the Beatitudes. First, we should perhaps define Beatitude itself. Supreme blessedness, perfect felicity, say the dictionaries. And this, which seems to come closest, the special blessedness announced in the Sermon on the Mount. Special indeed, above all, in its total unexpectedness. The first of the Beatitudes is probably also the most discussed. How blessed or how happy are the poor in spirit? But, writes Carlo Carretto,
who can claim to be poor in the biblical sense? The man who comes to understand, under the pressure of suffering or in the light of God, what it means to be human. The man who discovers his own limitations, who enters into the mystery of what it means to be a creature rather than a creator. Anyone, that is, who knows he is sick, small, weak, vulnerable, ignorant, sinful, needful of everything, who stands at the mercy of history and of wickedness in high places. Prisoner of hostile circumstances, who has learnt humility and discretion from the pain and anguish of his experience, who is thirsting for help and for love. The poor man, in short, is the man who has discovered his own limitations. He is blessed, and he becomes blessed, if he accepts such limitations as coming to him from the hand of God, in order that the kingdom might become a reality within him.
Few people can have been so close to the poor as Mother Teresa, now blessed in more ways than one. In 1982, after frequent meetings with Mother Teresa in Rome and in Calcutta, Sean Patrick Lovett compiled a book of her meditations. Here, in an exclusive and historic recording, are her thoughts on "Happy the pure in heart, they shall see God." In the version we heard today, "Blessed are the single-hearted," but somehow the word "pure" has a force all its own.
A pure heart is a heart that serves, a pure heart that is free to give, to love until it hurts. A pure heart can easily see Christ in the hungry, in the naked, in the homeless, in the lonely, in the unwanted, in the unloved, in the leper, in the alcoholic, the man lying in the street, unwanted, unloved, hungry. Because there is not only hunger for bread, there is hunger for love. There is not only nakedness for a piece of cloth, but there is that nakedness for that human dignity. It's not only homelessness for a small house to live in, but that homelessness of being abandoned by all, unwanted, unloved, uncared, having forgotten what is human love, what is human joy, what is human touch.
Blessed, too, are the sorrowing. They shall be consoled. A brief reflection on this theme comes from Andrew Jukes, a 19th century Anglican deacon.
I can tell you for an eternal truth that troubled souls are always safe. It is the untroubled that are in danger. Trouble in itself is always a claim on love, and God is love. He must deny himself if he does not come to help the helpless. It is the prisoners and the blind and the leper and the possessed and the hungry and the tempest-tossed who are his special care. Therefore, if you are lost and sick and bound, you are just in the place where he can meet you. Blessed are the mourners. They shall be comforted.
And what of the peacemakers? Surely they, in our war-torn world, are precious among the blessed. How many of them, though, have been eliminated by the violent? In the last half-century alone, the names multiply. Mahatma Gandhi, great soul, 1948. Martin Luther King, 1968. Anwar Sadat, 1981. And in more recent times, Yitzhak Rabin. Back in 1926, Gandhi had written,
"Non-violence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our very being."
In his book, Strength to Love, Martin Luther King tells of how he discovered the life and teachings of Gandhi.
"I came to see for the first time that the Christian doctrine of love, operating through the Gandhian method of non-violence, is one of the most potent weapons available to an oppressed people in their struggle for freedom."
When the bus boycott began in Montgomery, Alabama, where King had been pastor for a year or so, the people asked him to act as their spokesman.
In accepting this responsibility, my mind, consciously or unconsciously, was driven back to the Sermon on the Mount and the Gandhian method of non-violent resistance. This principle became the guiding light of our movement. Christ furnished the spirit and motivation, and Gandhi furnished the method.
Blessed be the peacemakers. They shall be called sons of God.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who produced and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now we take a look once again at the past week's events here in the Vatican. Our resident Vatican expert, Joan Lewis, sat down with me to review some of the highlights of the past 7 days.
Welcome back to the programme after another very full week in the Vatican.
Exactly. You know, when I sit in the studio to record this, it seems like minutes ago I was here talking about the preceding week, and another week has gone by. A busy weekend for the Holy Father, early part of the week. Tuesdays are usually quiet in the Vatican. The Holy Father is preparing the Wednesday audience. There's many other things he works on. He doesn't always have as many audiences, ad limina, visits of bishops or something else. But except for Tuesday, the rest of the week is usually pretty busy. I think a look back at Sunday was very interesting for a number of reasons. The Holy Father always comes out, you know, his appearance is like 20 minutes long, and he comes to his window to pray the Angelus with the huge crowds, typically huge crowds. This is January, not a big time for tourists and everything else, but I mean, there were like 40 or 50,000 people there this past Sunday. But the Holy Father comes out, he'll have reflections usually on the gospel of the day, and then he and the faithful will pray the Angelus, after which he makes reflections on other matters that are more or less dear to his heart. And actually, last Sunday, anybody who walked by St. Peter's Saturday probably wondered what the heck was going on. They were constructing kind of a very big stage, which they do the last Sunday of every January, because the youth Italian Catholic Action come. And they have been, you know, the whole month of January for them is the month dedicated to peace. And so two of the young children, usually a young girl and a young boy, join the Holy Father at his window, and they release two doves as a symbol of peace. Usually one of the two reads a little statement, the Holy Father reads a statement, and they release the doves. And what was really cute, when they released the doves, and any of us who have seen it in person or on tape know that in the past, with John Paul and with Benedict, one, sometimes two, of the doves would come back in the window. And so Benedict had a few laughs on Sunday because, just in off-the-cuff remarks, when the doves actually flew out of his window and stayed outside, the Pope said, well, this time it went well. Sometimes they come back. And then just one more thing at the Sunday Angelus, the Pope did mention that this past Sunday was the World Day of Leprosy Sufferers. This was started 55 years ago by a person named Raoul Follero, and the Pope sent his greetings, obviously, to all those who might suffer from this and to those who take care of them as well.
Then we go on to Monday, which was a big day. Very important speech.
Exactly. The Pope met participants in a conference organized by the Académie des Sciences de Paris, the Paris Science Academy, and by the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. And the basic premise of his talk to them was that man, not science, must be the criterion of good. He said, while exact sciences have made prodigious progress, obviously, in their understanding of man and the universe, there's a strong temptation, and this is so interesting, to enclose human identity within the knowledge one can have of it. In other words, within that physical knowledge of science, things that can be proved to us. And he said, however, there must also be anthropological, philosophical, and theological research which highlight and maintain the mystery of human beings. And he said, human beings always stand beyond what can be scientifically seen or perceived. And man is a being created by God in the image of God, who is loved and made to love. He's not the result of mere chance, of converging circumstances of determinism. And man enjoys a freedom which transcends his nature. So very, very important words, a speech that had to be read slowly for some of the remarkable statements that the Pope made. But I think we all knew anyway that man and not science, again, must be the object of good.
This speech had quite a lot of echo in the newspapers.
It did. The Pope talking about faith and reason, which we're going to see a little later, or reason, faith and science, his remarks on those subjects usually do gather a lot of attention. Where science is involved, obviously, from the scientific community, and when it's faith and reason, you've got your theologians very much involved in that. So now Tuesday, we said, was our normally quiet days, and there it was not a direct papal event, should we say, or audience on Tuesday, but the Pope did send a telegram to Seraphim, the Metropolitan of Charistia and Skyros, for the death of his Beatitude Christodoulos. He's the Orthodox Archbishop of Athens in all Greece, and he died Monday at his home in Athens after a long battle, 7-8 months, with cancer. And he was a man who had tried to do a great deal. He was young, too. He was only 69. Beloved by many, many people in Greece and elsewhere. And he tried to do a great deal to prod the ecumenical movement along from the point of view of Catholic-Orthodox relations. And so in his telegram, Pope Benedict recognized the Archbishop's work, and of course he said naturally he hoped that, he didn't say these words, but you know, he hoped that the Holy Spirit would come down and help them choose a successor, which I understand the Greek Orthodox will do on February 7th. So, and of course obviously the Vatican sent a delegation to his funeral, which was on Thursday. And then also Tuesday in the Vatican, again not directly related, not a papal audience, but related to the Pope, you had the Cardinal Cordes, president of the Pontifical Council Quorum, presenting the Pope's Lenten message to the press. And interestingly enough, this office, Quorum, is often called the Pope's charity arm. Many, many monies that do come into the Vatican, they are responsible for getting out to those people or groups that need it in the case of a flood or like Katrina, or disasters in Africa and elsewhere. And the Lenten message focuses on the importance of almsgiving, the fact that we who can should give to take care of our brothers and sisters who need it, and we should do it not for the glory of ourselves, but for the glory of God. And it's almost like, you know, the right hand should know what the left hand is doing.
What is the theme of this message?
The theme is, of course, Christ made himself poor for you. And he was. I mean, Christ was not born into the higher strata of society at the time he lived 2,000 years ago. He was born poor. He died poor. He lived without really material possessions. Well, that's what he told his apostles to do when he told them to go out and evangelize and preach the gospel. And they were not to bring anything with him, but simply to go into people's homes and be welcomed. And it is very interesting how, again, the Pope stresses are trying to help our brothers and sisters, not doing it for our own glory. Hey, look what I did, or look how much I gave, or am I going to get a reward for doing this, or a plaque with my name on it? So that is not the important part of it. But what I thought was interesting, I think it was in answer to a question that he was asked, Cardinal Cordes talked about the fact of there are many aid agencies throughout the entire world. There's some associated with the UN on an international level. There's national and then there's local aid agencies. And he said the devastating thing with so many of these agencies, if you actually get to know them and watch them work, is how much of the money that comes in to them as donations. You and I send a check to ABC organization to, you know, help the poorer or the devastated someplace. And we don't know that maybe 80% of the money in that particular organization is for administrative expenses. So you send $100, 80 is going to go to pay people's salaries or something else, and only 20 will get to the people. And in light of that comment, what the cardinal underlined was the fact how the church agencies, be it Quorum and be it Catholic Charities, whatever, how very little of their money goes to administrative expenses. And he gave some percentages, and I know it was something like the Knights of Malta, only 7% are for administrative, so 93% goes to actually helping people. And he shows some other organizations, which just don't come to the top of my head right now. But I thought that was a very interesting thing. And he said, the reason I'm even mentioning this, he said, is because people might want to rethink their giving. And he said, oh, I think this is fascinating. When there are these huge media promotions of XYZ agency after a huge disaster has happened, he said they shouldn't only say send your money to the, you know, Red Cross or whatever, or to Quorum. They should also publicize exactly how that organization uses its money. So if you want to give $100 to somebody and you see that this international agency uses 70% for administration and Cor Unum uses 5%, well, I guess you know where you're going to send your money, whether you're Catholic or not, because you don't care about that. You care about the money getting to the victims.
Exactly.
Yeah. So an important message this week. We didn't talk too much about the content of the message, but I think that that's something. It's online. It's online and it's in 10 languages. So people can go to the Vatican website, and there's a little icon, and it says Lenten Message 2008. So you'll get to see it in your own language, and there's Dutch and a few others thrown into the normal ones.
Going on to Wednesday.
The Wednesday audience, one of the few times that I've ever actually attended one. You know, we're always working, so we don't get to attend those affairs. But the Holy Father did return after talking previous week about Christian unity. He returned to his theme of St. Augustine of Hippo. And it was a lengthy, interesting catechesis on Augustine, how he approached faith and reason. And the Pope chose one particular phrase of his on this question. And he said, Augustine was a passionate believer who recognized the importance of bringing together faith and reason. And it was he who taught that we should believe in order to understand and understand in order to believe. And time in a show like this, of course, does not allow us to go into something like this in greater depth. But again, this is something on the Vatican website that there are summaries of in various other languages if someone really wants to pursue it. And it was wonderful to attend the audience yesterday because the Christmas decorations were still up. But I don't know if our listeners know that for the Vatican, the Christmas season really kind of ends from the point of view of nativity scenes being up and trees and so forth on the feast, February 2nd, on the Feast of the Presentation. That's when the nativity scene will come down and, you know, in they're working to take it down in St. Peter's Square and
so
forth.
It should be down by the beginning of Lent.
Just a couple days away, right. Is February 6th. So, and then I think our time, of course, is running out, but I think one other thing I'd like to mention that happened this week was the Pope named a coadjutor bishop in Hong Kong. Now, why is that important? He's naming bishops and so forth all the time. First of all, coadjutor, our listeners should know, means he automatically succeeds the bishop or archbishop when that person retires. And in this case, that is very important. We are talking about China. That is very near and dear to the Pope's heart, to the heart of the Vatican. I know very much they would like to reestablish, under all the right conditions, reestablish diplomatic ties with China. Those were broken in 1951. So the naming of a bishop who's going to be very much a champion, as Cardinal Zen now is. You need a champion of religious freedom. Cardinal Zen has been espousing that for years. Interestingly enough, I discovered that the now Bishop of Hong Kong, Cardinal Zen, and obviously the new coadjutor, if I didn't say his name, it's Bishop John Tong Han, both of them were ordained bishops on the same day. So, interesting. But again, this is gives one a good feeling. If you look at Bishop Tong's background, it gives you a good feeling of a man who's been at the Cardinal's right-hand man, right side. He will be there. He's going to be a champion of religious freedom as well.
On that note, Joan, I think our time is really up. So,
God bless.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Vatican Radio's English program. Laudetur Jesus Christus.